You can't replace part of the brain. Like, you
treat them the same.
The source of truth for the medtech industry.
Coexists with the
robot. Robot understands things automatically.
Number one show in the medtech industry.
So Stryker got ahead of that and changed it. In the 90s, built $1 billion company that helped up high. A lot of things.
State of medtech.
With your host, Omar M. Khatib.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Now, many of you know that biohacking and longevity is something that I'm deeply interested in, mainly because, hey, like I'm getting older and I'm all about optimizing the body. One area that seems to be in every single biohacking conversation on longevity panel is the gut and the microbiome. A lot of information out there, but sometimes it's very tough to really look at what you can trust and what you cannot. You know, for many of you who might know this, you know, I went to medical school, but I'm not diving into like Harrison's internal medicine to learn about the gut because it's mainly pathology based and, you know, it's just too heavy, too clinical. And then on the other side of it, a lot of the content that's out there is just too surface level. This is why my good friend and an old podcast guest from another podcast many years ago, Dr. Austin Chang, who is the chief medical officer for the endoscopy division over at Medtronic, and also a clinician who's still practicing, published a new book. And I actually have that book here, which is called The Gut. It's called Gut, an Owner's Guide. It's a beautiful book for those who don't see it, mainly because it's very well put together, beautiful images, great text, but more importantly, it demystifies this whole thing about the gut. Things that, such as like, what should you actually eat to enhance your microbiome? What should you know about your poop? Like, there's a whole chapter on poop, but a lot of things that we should get more educated about. I'm a stickler for great books. This was really well done. And again, just for those who may not know Dr. Chang, great background. Again, chief medical officer over at Medtronic for endoscopy division, but still a practicing physician. He's actually the director of the endoscopic bariatric program at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals, and a prolific content creator on social media. If you don't follow him already, follow him on across social media, whether Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube. It's Austin Chang. So with that being said, let's get into our episode with Dr. Austin Chang on the gut. And for those who are interested, check the show notes below. You have a direct link there to buy his book. Go buy it off on Amazon. Get it as a gift. It makes a great coffee table read. It's a great read, period. So with that being said, let's get to our episode. Enjoy. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Hope you're doing well. I have an old friend, a bestie from the past, if I say. Somebody who I've had on, not on this show, actually, but in previous podcast. We actually talked about it beforehand. He and I last did our podcast back in like 2021, so it's been a long time. This is Dr. Austin Chang, my good friend. Many of you have seen him on LinkedIn. He's the chief medical officer for the endoscopy division at Medtronic, and soon to be now a published author for Gut and Owner's Guide. I'm very excited because I got a there it is. And I got access to it before its publication day. It publishes, you know, by the time this podcast is out, it's already available. So go order it on Amazon. I pre-ordered a bunch, but it publishes on my birthday, which was great. So I know it's already going to be a bestseller, you know. Dr. Chang, thanks so much for coming on the show. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, you know, I got to tell you, when I look at your career, you know, you're a practicing clinician, you're CMO at the world's largest med device company, you're a prolific content creator on social media. It's like, I should be a published author too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely something on top of my plate that I didn't expect to, you know, show up at this stage in my career, but it's been a wild couple of years since we last spoke.
No, totally. Yeah, before we dive into the book and everything, tell us a little bit, like, what has the last few years been for you as a clinician, sort of in these different worlds that are quite exciting and they're all kind of coming together for you?
Yeah. So, you know, previously I was a full-time clinician at an academic center in Philadelphia, and I went part-time to join Medtronic 2.5 years ago. And so I'm full-time at Medtronic, still, you know, practicing on the side a couple days a month, still doing procedures. And yeah, to your point, it's been a juggling act, and I still am active on social media. And I think it's all come together very nicely because I always tell people that I feel like I've been on social media kind of educating and talking about what I'm doing for a decade, maybe over a decade at this point now. And, you know, part of that was probably subconsciously trying to reach a wider audience and having some sort of population level impact. And so the Medtronic role, when it came up, really felt like it was a tangible way of doing that, of having that sort of an impact. And so it's been a great journey. I've always been interested in innovation in our space and, you know, how technology comes together, how it, you know, goes to market. And I've just been learning a ton and trying to soak it all in. And of course, with these, you know, with how these worlds have collided into this hybrid career, I've been, you know, very fortunate to be approached with a lot of different opportunities like the book. And yeah, this is just yet another step, I think, to trying to get more accurate health information out there for the general public.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's exciting about your book is that gut health and microbiome has become, like, you know, very popular. I mean, I see things about it on Instagram all the time. There are definitely books on it, but this is the first true clinical book. And the best part is, and again, like, true to your brand, is that it's beautifully done. Like, you know, just, I don't have the physical book yet, but just the manuscript you sent me, the charts and graphs and illustrations are phenomenal. You have history in there, you have clinical stuff. I love it. But, you know, why does the world need a book on gut health, first of all?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about the gut, and it's a very complex system. You know, part of what drew me to gastroenterology and the gut in the first place was because there's so much variety and diversity in how many different organs there are. I think people often think that, oh, everything about the gut is just intestinal, but really, even within the intestine and that tract, the gut, it's, there's the esophagus and the stomach, and there's also the liver and the pancreas. And we've become so subspecialized as well that there's just so much more that we're constantly having to learn. And yeah, I think that that was part of the motivation, was distilling all of that down to something that's much more understandable and digestible, pun intended. And also, yeah, doing it in an illustrated visual format was really appealing to me. And so there are also sections within the book after every chapter to debunk some of those myths and, you know, clarify some of those misconceptions. And like you said, it's very clinical in the sense that, you know, not only is there kind of the common conversations around gut health and microbiome and things like that, but also like the various diagnoses that we commonly encounter within gastroenterology, its treatments, the procedures that we do. You know, I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to hone in on that was because we recommend all these procedures to patients, right? They see me in the office and then we tell them, okay, you need XYZ type procedure, but they don't have really a resource to go home and read about it and feel comfortable about it. And part of my goal, even on social media, has always been to try to make medicine a little less intimidating. And so being able to kind of articulate what it is that they're going to encounter when they show up to the hospital or the office, even, you know, why is it that your doctor is going to listen to you in this way? Why are they feeling your abdomen? Trying to make it less of a mystery before actually coming into CS, I think, is really important. And yeah, I hope that, you know, people really benefit from it and can feel more comfortable coming to CS and be more informed and therefore have a more productive conversation while they're there with us.
No, absolutely. And before we kind of dive in, like, clinically, you know, I think you're absolutely right, which is, you know, I've had my own interest in, like, gut health and microbiome, but especially, like, reading your book, it made me kind of realize that if you think about it, the gut, which of course includes the esophagus and colon and everything else, it's the only thing that's technically bringing something from the outside world into the body. And then every single organ, from your eyes to your brain to your heart, liver, everything is plugged in and is influenced by it, which makes it such an important thing. You know, so I think it's really exciting that, while granted, like, it dispels and gives you some guidance on pathology and everything, it also gives a good foundation of, like, what does good gut health look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, the general public doesn't often see this, but from my perspective, we see when things go wrong, how much the gut actually is involved with, you know, especially, you know, one, I think, example I have in the book is liver disease. And, you know, when the liver becomes cirrhotic or scarred down, there's a whole host of problems that occur. And it really opens our eyes up to like how intertwined the gut is with all the other organ systems out there. And that's what makes it interesting and fascinating. And that's also why I think there's a lot of innovation going into this space, both, you know, from a pharmaceutical perspective to, you know, procedural as well. So it's a very exciting space.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned some myths. Maybe we can, let's start there. What are some of the biggest myths when it comes to the gut and microbiome? And there's a lot of them, thanks to, you know, TikTok and these social media platforms where they're unregulated medical advice being, you know, handled out. Some of it's good. There's some good stuff out there. But for me, I mean, I at least, you know, spend time in medical school so I can tell the difference between those two things versus some of my friends who are very well educated. They'll show me something on Instagram and they're like, hey, like I, for biohacking my gut, this is what I learned. I'm like, no, that's actually a terrible idea. Yeah, but what are some of the big myths that are out there?
Yeah. I mean, some of the ones that come to mind, you know, that we get asked about all the time or that we hear about a lot are like leaky gut as a diagnosis, you know, leaky gut, intestinal permeability is a thing, but it's not necessarily a diagnosis recognized like in and of itself. So that's something like important to clarify. There's a lot that you see on social media about colonics or like colonic hydrotherapy, where a lot of water is being injected into someone's colon to like clean it out for whatever goal or reason that is. And, you know, there's from our perspective, a lot of safety concerns around doing that, you know, whether it's the risk of perforation of the gut, because the people who are administering that don't really know the anatomy. They're unable to see inside.
Or they're doing it at home by themselves.
Yeah. I mean, they're like putting, you know, like a shower head up basically like, you know, up someone's anus. And so there's, you know, there's issues there. And then also, you know, when they're infusing a ton of water at one time, there could be electrolyte shifts that happen that people don't necessarily anticipate. So it might not affect all people who get this done, but for some people, it could really be life-threatening potentially too. But yeah, in terms of like the gut microbiome, I think it's one of those areas within GI, within gut health, where our understanding is still evolving. And, you know, there's a lot that's, you know, being studied right now, and I really hope that it becomes much more of a mature space. But I feel like there are certain things about probiotics being recommended that aren't aligned with, you know, our professional society guidelines. There's still very little we know about, like, what are the appropriate bacterial strains? What are the dosages of probiotics? Like, you know, it has to be very personalized. And I think it also has to take into account the context of, you know, the patient in terms of their medical history and their, you know, other medications that they're on and, you know, other things like that. So, you know, as much as like it talks about, my book talks about gut health itself, it's also just reminding readers to know that, you know, there's a lot that's unique to an individual's situation. And so you really got to talk to your doctor to understand, okay, how does this fit into everything else that's going on with your health?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're seeing is, you know, I guess you can call it the Joe Rogan effect, which is, you know, Joe has, I mean, there's never been somebody like him in history with that much reach. And, you know, one of the more famous people who are on his show, from at least from the jiu-jitsu world, was this guy, Gordon Ryan. He's just super famous, just undefeated jiu-jitsu guy. But he, you know, he went out of competition, almost had to retire early because, you know, he went on antibiotics. It ruined his gut microbiome. And then he ended up with like a really bad, like fungal growth or something essentially in the gut. So I think the general public is very interested in learning about this. The problem is that they just go to the wrong resources. So let's start with the first thing, which is for you as a clinician who's an expert on the gut, what are sort of the macro and micronutrients that you look to get like every single day to sort of maintain like good gut microbiome?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, generally speaking, I try not to overthink too much about the diet. I feel like as long as we keep it diverse and varied and, you know, the things that you probably know already in terms of, you know, having a high fiber diet, more rich in like whole foods, not like processed type foods, that usually involve more vegetables and fruits versus like, yeah, processed artificial foods. And then also reducing the amount of red meat intake. Like that's really what I stick to. But like macronutrients, I think I try to pay more attention. It depends on everyone's individual goal, right? Like I think I talk to a lot of patients of mine who are seeking some sort of weight loss solution. And so I often remind them to focus on, you know, protein and maximizing that, because, you know, at the same time, as much as losing weight sometimes is important, I think like building muscle mass is also important. And then micronutrient wise, you know, ensuring that I think there's also a common misconception that everybody has to be on like a multivitamin or something like that. You know, growing up, I certainly was told that by my parents, but we don't necessarily have to. I think as long as we maintain a balanced, diverse diet, we often can get that from what we're eating. But of course, you need to talk to your doctor, because a lot of us may actually have vitamin deficiencies and require supplementation in those situations. And of course, yeah, in those situations, you definitely want to make sure that you're eating certain types of food, supplementing appropriately to make sure you're not missing out on some of those nutrients.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, just because it's become very, very popular and controversial, is the consumption of red meat. You know, there's one camp there like red meat is the devil. Don't ever eat red meat. More recent people talk about, I think it's called the ancestral diet, or of course the carnivore diet, which are just like, mm-hmm. eat all red meat, don't eat vegetables, because vegetables have plant defense chemicals in them, you know, which just to kind of dispel that for the listeners, like, yes, some vegetables do have plant defense chemicals, and it does cause like stress on your body, just like sauna and lifting weights and other things. So like some stress on your body is actually good. But talk to us a little bit about like how somebody should think about like red meat intake, you know, like what would you consider too much? And then like, why is too much red meat bad? Mm. Aside from the fact that if you eat a lot of red meat and very low like vegetables and fruits, you're going to have a hard time in the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's hard to judge someone's diet, because it's also like a matter of what's available to them, what culturally they are used to, right? And so, but I think generally speaking, I'm in the camp of reducing the amount of red meat that you eat. That said, I am never somebody to, you know, totally exclude everything. I feel like when you're depriving yourself of something completely, it can often have like some sort of backfire. It could have some sort of opposite effect. With your mental health and kind of, you know, just like how you approach food in general. So I would say limit it in terms of how much, you know, it's hard to say. I try to, you know, maybe like a daily red meat intake is probably not the best idea. And the reason why I'm of that camp of limiting red meat intake is because we do have clear evidence to show that there is a good, a pretty strong association with certain conditions like colorectal cancer. And so, you know, versus like vegetables and whatnot, we're probably not seeing that kind of an association quite as strong if people are trying to make that argument. So yeah, I think just in general, limiting it, you know, is a good approach to begin with.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. I think like the big thing that you're trying to give to people is that not to over-index on like one thing or another. You know, I think like for me, I swung between all kinds of different diets. I was like interested in this and that. And then just recently, I just realized, I'm like, you know what? Like, as long as I don't eat too much, I eat like good, whole unprocessed food. You know, overall, I'm good. Something that I found fascinating in your book is this idea that your gut is really connected to your brain in the sense of influence of neurotransmitters, you know? And like one of the like interesting examples is like, you know, if you eat like, let's say too much candy and everything, you can influence your gut microbiome so that certain neurotransmitters are released. So you crave more sugar, right? Talk to us a little bit about the gut brain connection.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a lot of emerging evidence in this space, and it's interesting, like in some ways, right. We, know that there's a gut brain connection because certain, conditions like gut health conditions can, basically alter your sense of pain and alter your, you know, perception of like what's happening with your gut. But I think in my opinion, what is even more interesting is even while I was writing this book, there was a study that was emerging or that had been published, where they were finding a linkage of how stress and, you know, mental health conditions could also have an effect on the gut, in an inflammatory type response. So it's very much bi-directional. And yeah,
what about the other way around? Is that possible? Is that a possibility where your gut microbiome could essentially make you psychologically more stressed or depressed or anything like that?
It could. I mean, I think that, you know, what we consider like irritable bowel syndrome and conditions, those are actually disorders of the gut brain axis, is like what we're calling that. That's like actually the technical categorization these days. I think in terms of that specific linkage of the microbiome to the brain, you know, we're still figuring out what exactly that association is, you know, what bacterial strains and whatnot. But yeah, I do feel like over the coming years, we're going to definitely find out a lot more about the specifics of this. And, you know, like what you alluded to earlier, it's not just pain and, you know, those types of signals, but also, you know, hunger and satiety and weight loss and weight gain. And, you know, part of the reason why I think it's gaining a lot of attention now is also, you know, GLP-1 agonists and all the medications, you know, targeting weight loss. Those are targeting hormones, right, that are dictating hunger and satiety. And so that's a pretty clear example of how that could potentially, how that linkage exists between like the gut and the brain.
You know, on that same topic, I mean, you're also clinically an expert on the areas of weight loss. I'm wondering, and again, I think it's gonna be different for everybody, but let's say it's somebody that's a loved one of yours, or I mean, you're in really good shape, so we won't use you as an example, but somebody you love, and they're considering altering their gut to hit their weight loss goals. Would your preferred approach be a pharmaceutical one, like a GLP-1, which is, you know, of course, very effective, or a more physical procedure one, such as like a sleeve, you know, getting a gastric bypass sleeve? Which do you choose first and why? And you cannot tell me it depends on the patient. You can't see the patient, but you have to, you have to have a preference. Which one and why?
That is so difficult to answer because, I mean, there are certain criteria out there that dictate whether or not you're even eligible for a procedural option versus not. So that right off the bat, some people just might not be eligible for a procedure.
Let's say they're eligible for both. What do you choose?
Yeah. I'll say like nowadays, I have to say it depends on how much weight you are looking to lose, because this might be different now in 2024 versus like 2 years from now, because the weight loss medications are becoming so incredibly effective in reducing total body weight that I think we're going to see a growing role for medications. I think like right now it might be like, oh, there are very clear scenarios where surgery or endoscopy is the right option. But in the future, I think that distinction might be a little less clear. That said, I'm going to tell you that when I see patients in clinic, a lot of them come to me because they are nervous about being on a medication long term, and so that's why they want a procedural option, and which they, you know, would consider more durable because they're actually altering their anatomy. And at the end of the day, I honestly feel like they're going to be complementary therapies. You know, just because you get a surgery doesn't mean that you can't get additional weight loss from a medication. And the fact of the matter is that any one of these solutions have a limit as to how much weight loss you can get. So if you combine them, the result might not be completely additive, but they are complementary, and you might get more mileage out of your treatment plan.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and it is really interesting, especially with GLP. I mean, GLP-1 has had such a strong impact that even, you know, Stryker had to come out and comment about its impact on its implant business, you know. But actually, interestingly enough, they feel like it's going to grow because it's going to make more people who are ineligible for receiving like knee implants, like to actually get them, you know.
Yeah, it'll
be
exactly.
Interesting to see what happens.
I'm excited. Yeah, I'm excited for this space because I think that so many people have had, you know, even if you're considering bariatric surgery, of the segment of the population that's eligible to get surgery done, only 1% actually undergo bariatric surgery. So that's a huge unaddressed, you know, portion of the population there, and millions of people, right? So finally, people are able to access, you know, another way of losing weight and I always say, and this is something that I talk about in the book, is that weight loss is a very personal decision. So, you know, not everyone has to necessarily lose weight. And I think, you know, it's, as a physician, I always like to think, try to frame it in a clinical perspective rather than like a cosmetic one. And so ultimately I do think that even, you know, the benefit probably of the weight loss, movement with GLP-1s is probably going to be pretty huge when, in terms of reducing downstream, you know, heart disease and all sorts of other problems that we know are associated with obesity.
Got it. Let me pivot real quick. You know, another area, chapter of the book you covered is talking about sleep, which I love. And again, this is why it's a great book. A, it is, you know, as somebody who collects a lot of books, I have a massive library, really well done, fun to read, illustrative, clinical, but not too clinical. It's great. You talk about sleep, and I'm wondering, you know, what is your recommendation to patients? If you can talk about the sleep chapter, how important the gut health is for sleep, but more importantly, this thing is, when do you eat? Like there's been all kinds of things about, you know, make sure not to eat after a certain hour of the day. Don't eat within a few hours of going to bed. Somebody like Brian Johnson, who's a biohacker, his last meal of the day is at noon, to give like 6 to 7 hours of rest before he goes to bed. I can't do that. What's your recommendation when it comes to gut health and sleep? You know, what are some of your key tenets?
You know, I think, again, on the theme of not trying to over-index on any one thing, I feel like it really depends on, you know, one's lifestyle and whether or not you're even able to incorporate some of these recommendations. I think there's good evidence behind some techniques like intermittent fasting, but not everyone is able to carry that out. So people shouldn't be stressing over trying to achieve that. I think that, you know, just from a very, again, clinical perspective, there are certain conditions that we, or certain scenarios where we recommend people don't eat too late, because otherwise they're going to develop heartburn when they're lying down. And we're going to, you know, see all sorts of problems the next morning because of that. But for a lot of people, it's not a problem, and they can consume food like before going to bed, and it's not that big of an issue. So in my opinion, it just really depends on like what your body's able to handle and what your lifestyle permits. And if you overthink it too much, then that sort of stress and the loss of sleep that you get as a result is probably going to just, it'll backfire on your plans. So, but yeah, I think that the relationship between sleep and like how to really harness it to benefit your gut health is still very much an emerging area. And I personally would love to see more work done on it, because, you know, I know that right now, especially like with all the technology out there and monitoring sleep, right, there's a lot of very popular technology, consumer technology to help people monitor sleep. That relationship and linkage to the gut is still very much in its nascency. So
no, I completely agree with you. And I mean, I think it's interesting. I think if anything, I'm happy that there's more public awareness and interest, right? I think public interest in medicine and health is pretty much at an all-time high. I don't think it is directly correlated with COVID, but just during 2020, I think people got more interested in their health. And now as a result, like there's just more consumer awareness for it. And of course, a lot of like investments and everything going into it. What about for yourself? Like, do you have your own golden rules for like sleep and your gut health? Like, do you prefer not to eat anything at night? And this is just specific to you, but yeah. You know, my audience is going to ask me that anyway. So like, I might as well just ask you, what do you prefer to do?
Honestly, you know how like people say doctors are the worst patients. So I am certainly an example of that, given like how much I'm juggling day to day, that I could definitely use more sleep, and yet I don't get enough. So I know what I should be doing, but I don't necessarily get around to doing it. And so, yeah, I don't really follow like a specific, like I don't intermittent fasting myself. I do think like when it comes to healthy eating and making sure that I'm eating a diverse, you know, balanced diet, I do pay attention to that. I don't overlimit myself though. I still, you know, I'm very mindful that like, oh, if I'm going to, you know, eat something that maybe isn't the best for me at one point in the day, that like later on in the day, I'm going to, you know, shift a little more and be more mindful about what choices I'm making later in the day. And I had to learn that lesson in some ways. Like, I was forced to learn that lesson, I think, early on in taking the Medtronic job, because I was traveling so much. And I realized, you know, with a lot of work dinners and like being on the road, that I'm not able to control what I eat quite as, you know, easily as if I were just at home. And yeah, so I found myself, my go-to meal, I often tell people, is like poke.
Because I'm with you. I love poke.
I love poke. And it's like, you know, I can, you're choosing the ingredients pretty much. You can often like get your fix of vegetables and fish. And it's, for me, it's like, it makes me feel like I'm making a healthy choice then.
No, I totally hear you on that. Just kind of like going through your book. And again, like one of the things that I personally enjoy is, you know, it's a fun book to read, because you have, I mean, you have text in it, of course. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it a book. But aside from the illustrations, you know, you have these interesting areas on in the book around questions like, you know, like quick, you know, it's almost like, you know, I always judge authors based on how they design the book. And you design the book for like a modern audience, in the sense that, like, you know, they might have just quick questions. So you have like different lists, like questions on like, should I avoid antibiotics? Is intermittent fasting a good way to lose weight? And you have your kind of quick answers to that. I'm wondering, like, what was the most fun chapter of the book for you to write and why?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd probably say the poop chapter. you know, when I was working on this with the publisher, you know, we had a lot of back and forth about what the table of contents should be about. And I think they saw that there was just so much I could talk about around poop that they wanted to make an entire chapter about it, which I love, because I think we got to destigmatize conversation around poop. Obviously, it's not necessarily everyone's dinner table conversation, but I think we should feel more comfortable talking about it. And you know, the reason why I think a lot of, there's a lot of, you know, we don't talk enough about colorectal cancer and things like that, is because people are afraid of talking about butts and guts. And so that chapter is particularly fun, because it's not only, it's very visual. There's charts about, you know, stool consistency. There's a whole poop rainbow, which is like how to interpret different color of your stool. Like if you see, notice that your stool is gray or green or black, like what does that mean? What could it mean? That's actually an adaptation. This whole book is in some ways an adaptation of my social media presence and what I've, you know, the voice I use on social media. But that in particular is actually based on a video off of YouTube that I made a couple of years ago. And they really wanted that in text form. And so, I was very excited to write that. And like you said earlier, like visually, you know, part of the sell for me on this is, when the publisher approached me about this book, they said, hey, you know, our forte at DK, the publisher, which is a Penguin Random House imprint, their forte is illustrated, colorful books. And I said, say less. I think that's like perfect for what I'm trying to do here. So I'm really glad that, you know, we came together and were able to create this. So yeah, I would say the poop chapter was probably the most fun to write, but there's so many aspects of this that I just love. Like the debunking sections, like the your questions asked at the end of every chapter gave me like a nice concise way of addressing common questions. There's like the history of gut health, which most people don't know. Even within my field, I think a lot of physicians don't know the history of how our field came to be. So it's exciting to just remind ourselves of all the cool milestones that we had, all the, you know, what areas within GI were awarded Nobel Prizes, for instance. It was a learning experience even for myself, just putting this together.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, and I did like the poop chapter, because it's not something people normally want to talk about, but it is really important, because it's, you know, kind of gives you an idea of what's going on. And I think general public knowledge of like how to assess that, like, you know, again, the different colors of the poop does indicate sometimes what's going on, you know. Mm-hmm. I think people, you know, I think this is the big, I wonder your take as a clinician. I think the big movement now is, aside from arming people with like health tech and devices at home, is really arming them with some basic knowledge, so that people get, they get much better about monitoring themselves at home and getting themselves to professional help sooner rather than later, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I always say that access, you know, we always talk about improving access to healthcare. access to healthcare for me isn't just access to a physician or a procedure or care, but also access to information. And that's sort of always been my mission on social media, right? Was to, how do we get accurate health information to the masses? Because, you know, it shouldn't be confined to only the brief physician visits that we get, which often are just several minutes long before you're, you know, out back at home on your own trying to figure it out yourself. So I think hopefully people can be empowered by this text and be a little more informed and at least understand, you know, how to bring something up in conversation a little more easily.
So on that same token, sort of flip side of the question, like what was more like, let's say difficult chapter for you to write and why? Can't be the poop chapter.
No, it wasn't the poop chapter. I think the difficult parts to write were probably the ones that are most interesting, right? Like the stress in the gut, the sleep in the gut sections, like there's so much gray area, admittedly, in those sections, that how do I balance the idea that there's a lot of promise in this area and that we should, you know, pay a lot of attention to it, but not give too much that's concrete and over promise on some of these sections. And so those are particularly difficult. I would also say even just the most science heavy portions, like where I think the biggest chapter is about the various GI conditions. And there's only so many diagnoses that I can list. I had to cut some out because of the length of the book, but we still wanted to highlight, you know, what we commonly encounter in our field, just so that people get an understanding of like, okay, there's more to gut health than just what you hear about often about reflux and you know, IBS, and there's so much more that people should understand. Yeah, I think that that's probably what I'd say were the most difficult parts to write.
Got it. And just kind of rounding this out again, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It shouldn't have taken this long, so shame on me, but I'm glad we were able to get you on. I know you love all of them, yeah. but what if you had to pick two or three of your favorite gut-friendly foods, foods that you know that are like, hey, if I eat enough of this, it's gonna be good for my gut microbiome, like guaranteed. You know, for sure. What comes to mind for you?
I would say certain fermented foods. So like sauerkraut, kimchi, kombucha, take your pick. I'm not a big fan of kombucha myself, honestly.
I was going to say, plug for them. I had this Mighty Booch, which is 100% raw, real kombucha. I had some kimchi. Okay. I love kimchi. But the problem, it just stinks up the whole place. But it's so good. It's so good. It's worth it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I love kimchi. I think, you know, fermented foods is like, those are an easy way to introduce like probiotics, even though we don't know exactly which ones we're introducing. But generally speaking, it's a good way to kind of populate the gut with that. And then I would also say, you know, there's some good evidence out there that we often cite within our field about kiwi and how, you know, there's high fiber in kiwi and how it can promote bowel movement. So there was a big study that showed benefit, you know, in patients with constipation and how it's able to relieve that. And in some ways, if we think about like prebiotics, right, I think like there's a lot of talk about prebiotics out there. Prebiotics is basically just fiber. And so if we're going to talk about like recommended foods, I think kiwi and other high fiber fruits and vegetables, I think, you know, can help promote a good, you know, microbiome, because it's basically like prebiotics are what the microbiome is like eating, or you can kind of think of it as like, this is what it's fueling. What's fueling the gut microbiome are the prebiotics.
Yeah. And I think that's really good advice, because again, like, for me, I consider myself like somewhat of a biohacker. So I do like optimizing, but at the end of the day, I also try and think like, okay, you know, I can take different supplements and pills and whatever, but at the end of the day, you can never go wrong with eating like good, clean, whole food. And so I think that's really helpful. So like for your fiber, if you had to, that's actually a really good tip. I never knew about that. So your number one prebiotic high fiber pick of choice is kiwis.
I would say so. Yeah.
Interesting. I did not know that. I love kiwis.
There was that, I think it's based off of the fact that there was this study published, and it was published in a very reputable journal. I think that I'm sure there are other fruits out there and vegetables out there that probably carry the same amount of fiber and are probably just as effective, but that's like what we have to go off of. So if you love it, then great. And if not, there are others, you know, other fruits out there that can serve that purpose.
Just out of curiosity, you know, because one of the areas that people think about when they think about fiber, they think about like brands like Metamucil and stuff, or anything with like what is Metamucil made out of?
Psyllium husk.
There you go, psyllium husk. Yeah. You know, for people who want to have something that they just take daily, would psyllium husk be the thing that you recommend, or is it something else?
Yeah, I personally would recommend that. And in fact, this is not an endorsement of Metamucil, but I take Metamucil daily as well.
It tastes amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it comes in different forms. There's like the orange powder that you mix with water. And there's also like, they have like the cinnamon crackers or whatever it is. In any case, yeah, I think it tastes great. So, and it helps not only.
I had no idea. There's a cinnamon Metamucil.
There's like an apple cinnamon. I remember this as a kid and I'm pretty sure it still exists. I think it's an apple cinnamon cracker. You got to look it up. I don't know if it still exists or not, but
I'm checking it. I'm checking right now. Oh my God. Yeah, there it is. They have Metamucil crisps.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh wow. There you go.
Yeah. So you can, you know, literally eat it in like cookie form, but yeah, I think not only does it promote good consistency bowel movements, but you know, the more we understand about prebiotics and how it can fuel the gut microbiome, there's also potential benefit there.
Got it. And then, you know, the last thing I want to sort of round out, you know, the interview, we talked about it before you came on, but, you know, there's a lot of money going into microbiome health tech. I won't mention any company names, but there's a lot of interesting companies that, since you send you a kit, they, you know, start tailoring probiotics for you and stuff. You know, for the microbiome stuff that's out there, I mean, what's your take on it?
I think that right now, I love that there's a lot of attention in this space and that it's growing. I think that it's a little premature. I think physicians, right, like when we're actually on the flip side of trying to interpret some of the results of these tests, like we don't know exactly what to do with them because there's not a great solution often to treat, you know, whatever it is that's found on these as a result of these tests. So I would say it might be informative, but, you know, in terms of actually having clinical impact, I think time will tell. I think there's got to be a little more evidence generated from that. But talk to your doctor, because everybody has, you know, a little bit of a different situation. And I do kind of, on that same note, I love the movement of just empowering patients with the ability to do things at home, right? Like there's so much, I think, so much time spent at home, and often people are unable to come to the hospital to begin with, or it's just like very much a to-do. And to be able to do some of this testing, generally speaking, I think is a good trend. And I would love to see that develop in so many other areas. So I'm hopeful and optimistic that we'll learn more and be, you know, we'll have actual just a more concrete understanding in the years to come.
Perfect. And then last question before you go, and thanks for jumping on. I know it's late over there in the East Coast, but you know, what's your hope for your readers, you know, who buy the book? You know, we'll hopefully drive a lot of our audience to go purchase the book, but what's your kind of hope for the readers when they buy your book and they get the physical copy and everything? What are you hoping that they do with it, and how do they use it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's just even from a very high level perspective, I would love for it to just destigmatize the field and allow people to have an open conversation about gut health. You know, even if it's a coffee table book, right? Just sitting there, to be able to have that conversation with your friends and family is already a great start. And then from there, I think just the myth busting sections and clarifying things, just knowing that it's coming from a place where it's based on the best available evidence that we have at the moment, because medicine's very dynamic. Some of this could change over the next couple of years, but to know that, you know, the myth busting sections are there to serve you, and make sure that you're not being misled, or that you're not wasting your money, or not, you know, substituting your actual treatment plan with things that are not based on evidence, or on things that are not well regulated, right? Because there's a lot out there that that's being promoted, that's over the counter, that's available to you online, that isn't very well regulated the way medical devices are or pharmaceuticals are. So I just think in general, empowering people to understand a little more about their gut health and have a conversation with not only their doctors, but those around them.
Fantastic. And I completely agree. And again, I bought one for myself. I bought one for also one of my closers, another physician, Dr. Dan Roshan, who's been tearing it up on LinkedIn. He makes some interesting posts just on a lot of like top. He's in family medicine, sports medicine. So he makes great content, but I know he's going to love it. So with that being said, Dr. Cheng, before you leave, where can people find you online? Pretty much everywhere, but like where is your, you can give us a few places to go that you'd like people to give you a follow.
Yeah, it's pretty consistent. My handle is pretty much the same everywhere, Austin Cheng, MD. And you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Instagram, TikTok. I'm not as active on YouTube, but there's some, you know, perennial content on there, and X as well, Threads. I'm basically every major platform you know of, I'm probably there.
Yeah. Being in the social media world, man, I know how it is. It's just like, there's too many of them to keep up.
Yes, it's a lot. So,
well, Dr. Cheng, thank you so much for coming on the show. Hey, congratulations on the new book. Really excited thank for you.
Thank you awesome. So much.
Absolutely. So everybody, be sure to go and get Dr. Cheng's book. By the time this episode is released, it is available on Amazon. So just type in gut and Austin Cheng and it'll come up right away. Order a few of them. They're I think those are great books as a present because they're beautiful. I got the manuscript, so I looked inside. I'm really excited to get it. So that being said, I'm your host, Omar Khatib. This is the State of MedTech, and we'll see you all next time. Thank you for enjoying another epic episode of the State of MedTech. If you're feeling inspired and love this episode, do us a favor, hit that subscribe button and turn notifications on so you never miss an episode. And be sure to give us 5 stars and write a short review because that helps more people discover this amazing community of ours. If you're a company who has a executive that you'd like to be on the show, or perhaps you want to sponsor one of the episodes, shoot us an email at hello@khatibandco.com. Take care. See you next time.